Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. Bruce Ash welcoming you to a special Monsoons Are Coming edition of Inside Track. We have a great show for you today. We'll hear from newly appointed Arizona Corporation Commissioner Leah Marquez Peterson, who will tell us about her new job, and from Pastor Roy Tolgren of Gospel Rescue Mission about the wonderful new Center of Opportunity, which just opened in Tucson on June 3rd. We'll talk about everything from utility costs to rescuing people from homelessness. It's going to be a great show. Hey, just a couple words before we get to our first guest. Having spent so long defaming conservatives as racists, progressives apparently are turning the accusations on each other. 2 weeks ago, Democratic presidential contenders all but called Joe Biden a segregationist. This past week, Nancy Pelosi got a taste of her party's own poison. The House Speaker has lately criticized some of the most extreme progressives in her caucus for cultivating their own celebrity status at the expense of the party. Mrs. Pelosi had four of her caucus's freshmen, especially in mind: Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Omar of Minnesota, Presley of Massachusetts, and Tlaib of Michigan. These four, in addition to trumpeting socialist measures, flirting with anti-Semitism, and using Twitter to criticize moderates in their own party, voted against last month's emergency spending bill for the southern border. They did so even though three of them have compared what's happening at the border to the Holocaust. With that, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez decided to resort to her default defense. "This is persistent singling out," she told the Washington Post, "and it's reached a point where it's just outright disrespectful. The explicit singling out of a newly elected woman of color." Well, Mrs. Pelosi is finally exercising some much-needed adult supervision over her caucus. Perhaps she and others will be a little less inclined to use race as a political weapon now that it's been used against her. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors: Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. Our guest is brand new Arizona Corporation Commissioner Leah Marquez Peterson. She certainly is a well-known leader here in Pima County. On May 31st, Doug Ducey named the former Republican congressional contender from Tucson to the agency that decides how much utilities can charge their customers. The announcement came just after the governor also announced that Andy Tobin would leave the Arizona Corporation Commission to head the State Department of Administration. Leah, the former president of the Tucson Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, will fill out the balance of Mr. Tobin's term in the Corporation Commission through 2020. And she will be the first Southern Arizona resident to sit on the commission since Paul Newman, a Bisbee Democrat, left office in 2013. The announcement comes at a particularly critical time at the commission, which is looking at whether Arizona Public Service, the state's largest electric utility, is entitled to another rate increase. Regulators gave the go-ahead in 2017 for APS to collect another $95 million a year from customers. Commissioners voted earlier in May not to reopen that rate case. On Thursday, after Tobin resigned, however, the commission voted to push ahead with a plan to have APS file a new rate case using 2018 as the test year to determine if the charges being imposed are too high or if they should be scaled back. So, Leah, you're a newbie to the commission, and you and your colleagues find themselves in the middle of a rate case, a pretty big rate case, pretty challenging. How are you getting up to speed?
You know, this has been such an honor, Bruce, to be elected by the governor for this position. It's interesting, the number of folks that have congratulated me, but very few know actually what the Arizona Corporation Commission does. So I've been spending time talking to folks about the fact that absolutely we regulate utilities, electric, water, wastewater. We also manage railroad crossings, pipeline infrastructure, the incorporation of businesses. So I'm really bringing my experience and Southern Arizona, as you know, being a small business owner and having run the largest chamber in Southern Arizona, to this seat. And it's been a whirlwind. As you know, APS is certainly in the headline, not only the rate case, but the death of Ms. Pullman, who which occurred last year, which was kind of a developing story that happened during my first couple weeks in the seat, and to the disconnect rules and emergency rulemaking that we acted on. It's really been interesting to get up to speed on the history and understanding just what impact the rules that we set have on everyone in Arizona.
So we're going to get to that accident briefly that involved that poor lady last year in just a moment. But let's go back to what the ACC does, because you talked about a lot of stuff very quickly. One of the things I didn't understand that the ACC was involved in, that's the Arizona Corporation Commission, was handling, I think you said, railroad crossings. Can you talk about that for a second?
Right. Certainly. Well, municipalities and communities apply to the Arizona Corporation Commission for railroad crossing, and it's a negotiation that happens with the railroad, and we approve those or deny them. So I've seen a couple of those come through in just the 4 or 5 weeks that I've been in this office. And it's interesting the breadth of the issues that the ACC really tackles.
And on pipelines, these would be natural gas pipelines, I guess, as well as oil pipelines or gasoline pipelines coming into Arizona as well?
Exactly, and it's the infrastructure, so it's the expansion or attraction of pipelines. And so my first day in office, really, and that the next couple of weeks, I spent time meeting with every division of the Arizona Corporation Commission, trying to meet the leaders and best understand what their priorities were, what were projects they were currently working on, what areas of the state it impacted. It's been very interesting.
You did a pretty smart thing, I think, Leah. I understand that you've essentially kept on all of Andy Tobin's staff who'd been there for a while. They certainly understood what Andy was involved in, and certainly you're taking over a lot of those responsibilities. Working with them, I guess, has been sort of a godsend to you, meaning that they can get you up to speed.
Very helpful. Yeah, very helpful. You know, I think it would have been very challenging to start day one knowing that I had an open meeting coming up that next week, not having the staff that was familiar with protocol and how the open meetings were run and amendments, as well as the history. They did a great job for Commissioner Tobin. One is an attorney, one is a kind of a water policy energy expert. So that's been very, very helpful.
Yeah, so getting back to this APS case, what all has to happen before the case is actually heard? Is this a pretty extended process that goes on?
Yeah, my understanding is it takes them sometimes, 6 to 9 months to a year to gather all the information that they then put into a docket that is open to the public. People can review the information and see what we're going to be making our determination on. Open meetings are exactly that. You can watch them online on the website at azcc.gov or come on up to the hearings and meetings that occur either in Phoenix and in Tucson to weigh in. And I know, having been a resident of Arizona during the last rate case, these end up being highly contentious. People have a lot of different opinions. So I'm prepared to meet with folks throughout the state. I'm planning town halls and information meetings so that people can meet me and also give me their perspective on certainly this case and other issues that we're facing throughout the state.
Yeah. So, Leah, how did your experience running your own company as well as the Hispanic Chamber, do you think, prepare you for this position?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that surprised me my first week as I learned about ACC is that the number of water companies in our state, more than 1,500 of them, more than 300 are privately owned. Some of them are very sophisticated and larger, owned by large entities. Others are small mom and pop. So certainly my experience being a business owner helps me to relate to a lot of how these companies are determining their operational maintenance, their rate of return, how they're growing, how they're serving their customers, and that's been helpful. I think also the fact that the business incorporation is part of the Arizona Corporation Commission is very interesting to me. That's an area in which I want to focus. I want to see what we can do to streamline and make it easier to do business in Arizona. If you've ever opened a business, you know that you have to hop around a number of different agency websites to get things done. Secretary of State handles your trade name, you know, Corporation Commission, your incorporation. the ADOR handles your tax license. So I want to work closely with other agencies to see what we can do to make it easier to be able to go to one web portal or to understand how to get set up to do business in Arizona.
Well, I won't hurt you at all by saying, because I'm not being critical of you, you've had nothing to do with this, but sometimes dealing with the ACC on business startups has been difficult. And I guess some of that has to do with budgetary constraints. They only have so many people working there. But in a state like Arizona, where things are growing so fast, it might make sense for the legislature to give the ACC more money?
Yeah, I think that's certainly something that the commission staff is looking at. But I know that prior to me being there, they had quite a backlog on business incorporation that they have since caught up on, which is very good. So I want to do what I can to bring my own small business experience and experience working with thousands of businesses throughout southern Arizona, you know, bring that to the ACC and see what we can do to streamline things. I've also, as a chamber president, worked with hundreds of different industries, and that's been very helpful too. I dive into the different issues, whether it's electricity or water or wastewater or pipeline and so on, to help kind of bring my perspective to those different industries in terms of how they do business.
And having run the Hispanic Chamber and been part of a very public group for such a long time, you probably have a fairly good sense of what it must be like working with the public and transparency and so on, because as the chamber executive, it certainly was a very transparent organization, very public. You know, you were a face and a spokesperson for that great group.
Yeah, you know, I learned through my experience at the chamber that gathering people together, getting their information, their perspective on whatever the particular issue is vitally important. You can learn so much about different perspectives. I'm happy to see that the ACC operates that same way with hearings and workshops throughout the state, the open meetings that they have that often run 2 days long. So there's certainly room for lots of people to come and testify and to give their opinion. So I plan to continue to operate in that fashion. And you may know also that there are five commissioners that are, make up the ACC, and I'm the only one that's not living in from Maricopa County. So I'm keeping that in regard so that I know that truly I'm representing everyone throughout the state, but I have a particular soft spot, obviously, for southern Arizona and for rural Arizona, because I've done so much work in Douglas and Sierra Vista and Nogales and other parts of the state. So I really do want to make sure rural Arizona and southern Arizona's voice is heard in regard to ACC matters.
So before we take a break, Leah, for a couple commercials from our sponsors, just if you wouldn't mind, sort of a personal question, but talk briefly about the travel requirements and kind of the adjustments that you and your family are having to make with this new position.
Yeah, that's a good question. The position is based in Phoenix, and that's where the Arizona Corporation Commission offices are and the staff. However, I asked permission to open a Tucson office, and I've since done that. So the Arizona Corporation Commission has an office based in 400 West Congress, downtown Tucson, and I've set myself up there so I can do a couple days a week in Tucson and a couple days a week in Phoenix. In between that, I plan to be traveling throughout the state, visiting all different corners of the state, again, so that I can hear from people and they can meet me and so on. So my family's aware of that, very supportive. They may even be coming along with me on some of these trips, who knows. But it's something that I'm looking forward to meeting people throughout different places in Arizona. That I've traveled in the past as a chamber president, but will be wearing a different hat as an Arizona Corporation Commissioner.
Well, you're definitely a people person. We know that from watching you in action for so long with the Hispanic Chamber and then when you ran for Congress. Hey, let's take a quick break for some words from our sponsors. We're here with Leah Marquez Peterson, newly appointed ACC commissioner. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. We're here with Leah Marquez Peterson, ACC commissioner, one of five commissioners newly appointed. Let's talk for just a second about the rate case. Again, real quick, I don't want to focus on it too much. But in terms of the rate case, I mean, APS did make a nice profit last year, and that's a good thing. But there is always sort of a push-pull between profits and, you know, shareholders as well as the consumers and what their needs are. And then also, you know, this is an expanding state, Leah. You think you'd have to admit we're looking at a large population increase. The ACC is going to really help determine growing the power grid and all the electrical as well as other utility capacity here in Arizona. How does your role as a commissioner sit with respect to how to deal with the public and deal with the companies and deal with all of the growth issues that we have here in the state?
Yeah, and that's a good question, Bruce. The balance is really between you want the company to invest in infrastructure so they have the newest technologies and they're providing, you know, really safe, reliable utility services to our consumers throughout the state. At the same time, though, we need to keep in mind that it needs to be affordable. We have a lot of people in the state living on fixed incomes. It can't be dramatic increases. So we look at rate cases for all electricity companies, whether it's Tucson Electric Power or APS or others throughout the state. And so it's important that we hear from everybody from their perspective. And so that's something that we make sure that we get out throughout the state and hear from people, whether it's small business, large business, consumers, seniors, rural, urban. We need to hear everybody's perspective as we tackle these different rate cases.
Yeah, so the other thing that you guys are talking about also is about the expansion of renewables as a form of energy with our utility providers here in Arizona. I know last year at the Hispanic Chamber, the group had taken a position against an initiative that would have required APS and TEP to generate half of their electricity from renewable sources. But what is, you know, where do you think the sweet spot is and how many years to achieve that? I mean, have you come to any conclusions so far or, you know, based upon your past experience or what you've learned so far since you've been appointed?
Yeah, I've been gathering a lot of information related to that. The ACC, or the Arizona Corporation Commission, set a guideline of 15% by 2025. And I know that different utilities have been able to achieve different levels. In fact, I think TEP in the Tucson area has far exceeded that, and it's closer to 30%. APS is still working towards hitting that 15%. Co-ops are in different places throughout the state. So we need to really take that into consideration as we set goals for the state. One of the things that Commissioner Tilton has done in the past is work on an energy plan for the entire state of Arizona, as had other commissioners. And I think that's still something that we need to tackle as a state that's fast-growing. And there are a number of folks that have spoken to me, and I'm really in kind of that fact-gathering stage at this point.
Yeah. It's kind of a bureaucratic question. So on the commission, there's five of you. Is there leadership within the five of you as to the whole governance, or is there sort of a director from the ACC who kind of coordinates things? How do you decide how something gets on the agenda for that meeting? And you know, how does that work?
Yeah, we have a chairman, and it's Bob Burns, who you may know from
Sure.
You know, the House and the Senate at the state. He's been a leader a long time. He's the current chairman, so he sets the agenda.
Yeah, so Bob would set the agenda working with the members as well as the different administrative officials on the ACC?
Yeah, he works. We can, as commissioners, request things to be on the agenda. The staff, which there are, I think there's seven divisions and all their different leaders, can certainly put things on the agenda. And it's quite a packed agenda. I suggest you take a look online of all the different issues that we're talking about and we're hearing testimony on and ruling on right at that point. And again, I mentioned earlier, the open meeting, and I've been through one at this point, but it was 2 days long and it was packed full of information and lots of different speakers. So I'd say Arizona's really engaged in the positions and the actions that the ACC takes.
All right. Let me move to nuclear. This is a Bruce question, okay? Leigh, I never thought I'd say this, but my next vehicle, an SUV, is going to be an all-electric in 2022. And part of that's because all the automakers are going in that route. And part of it's because, like anybody else, I think we're all committed to, you know, clean, safe globe and you know, a good environment. But even though electric vehicles are referred to as zero emissions, they really aren't. Even natural gas-fired electric generation is a pollutant creator. Shouldn't, if all the vehicles, because all the automakers by 2022 are basically going to electric vehicles, doesn't Palo Verde potentially play a bigger role to reduce our total carbon footprint here in Arizona? I mean, I know for myself, this is, like I said, it's a Bruce question. I want to be assured that I'm part of the solution. I don't want to have an otherwise gas or coal-generated electrification program if I'm trying to be at zero emission. Is the ECC looking at expansion of Palo Verde, because we know that there's going to be more people in the state, and also now we're going to be trading gas stations for your own electric hook-ins in your private homes more and more in the upcoming years?
I haven't heard the ACC tackling the expansion of Palo Verde, but I will tell you, electric vehicles is a big part of our upcoming agenda and future agendas. In December, the ACC went ahead and ruled on and put in place an electric vehicle policy, and which was broad, but it also allowed a lot of electric vehicle companies and charging station entities to kind of know the direction that the ACC was going. We are tackling just this month an electric vehicle implementation plan, which then directs the utilities to start discussing pilot plans, which many of them already have, and kind of look to their direction in terms of what their engagement should be in identifying charging station locations throughout the state. I've received thousands of emails, Bruce, on this issue, both for and against, and lots of phone calls, because electric fuels is certainly the direction the automobile manufacturers and so on are going. But I've also learned that there's really that chicken and the egg situation. A lot of people don't want to buy electric vehicles until they know their charging station's in place, either at their home or in some public entity, and vice versa. So we really do need some of that infrastructure in place, and what will the utilities play is what's top of mind right now as part of the ACC agendas.
Yeah, well, 2022 is right around the corner, even though it seems like it's a long ways away. And I think in the entire country, there's 75,000 charging stations if you look around the country. Joe Biden had talked about increasing that to 550,000 charging stations within the first year if he was elected president. Well, that may or may not happen, but from the standpoint of just the reality of, gee, we're getting ready to have all these new vehicles that come online, it's something that has great urgency.
Yeah, and I still learned that more than 80% of people who have electric vehicles are charging at home. But as electric vehicles become more affordable, you're going to have people that perhaps don't own their own home owning these EVs.
Yep.
And then we've got to have public locations. There's range anxiety, which I had learned about just in the recent weeks, that you need to know that you can get to the next point and have a fast charging station, ideally. So it's been interesting to see where those are placed now throughout the state and where we have gaps.
So real quickly, before we sign off for today, and I want to have you back on a regular basis because you have served Southern Arizona and you want to serve Southern Arizona as a commissioner. Talk about education in conservation and what the ACC, working in conjunction with other state agencies or NGOs, might do to give people the advantages on, you know, what they can do to save on utilities, because the power companies are going to expand their capacities, but you know, we have to be doing our part on the other side to make sure that, you know, we're not wasting power as well. What does the ACC do, or what do you want to do to help with education for consumers?
Absolutely. One of the pieces that the ACC regulates is energy efficiency programs. And I know in the past, it varies around the state based on the utility, but in the past, even as a Hispanic Chamber president, I partnered with Tucson Electric Power on their Bright E program. They were struggling to get kind of the news out to small businesses about energy efficiency. So our Hispanic Chamber was holding workshops, providing free food and lunch to get business owners there and talk about the improvements that can be made on your building to make it more energy efficient. So I like programs like that. I think those seem to really work. I have not yet done the research in my first 4 or 5 weeks on how it varies by utility, but I think that's something that certainly I support, and we need to see that that's included in each of the regulations that we put together for each of the utilities.
Well, Leah, thanks very much for coming on the show today. We'll be checking back with you frequently, and I think I can speak for everybody here in Southern Arizona who know you and respect you. We think that the governor made a great choice when he selected you, And we wish you the very, very best of luck and good work. And come see us again real soon. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for the balance of today's show is a man that many of our listeners know and respect, Pastor Roy Tullgren of the Gospel Rescue Mission. Roy has not only been the face of Gospel Rescue Mission here for many, many years, he's also been a key component in the heart of this great organization. I've known about Gospel Rescue Mission since the 80s when we worked with them in Sierra Vista. Roy has dedicated his life to helping others and providing opportunity not only through a helping hand, but maybe more importantly, belief in what God can do to improve our lives. Thanks for joining us today, Pastor Roy.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be interviewed by you today, and looking forward to chatting a bit about Gospel Rescue Mission.
Yeah. Roy, let me read directly from the Gospel Mission website. Because the two central values of the organization, I think, are very instructive in these words of belief. We believe in God's grace, in His dealing with us, and in our dealing with others. We purpose to share God's gift of grace, His unmerited love and favor, which allows us to repent of sin and be saved by faith, transform our lives, and calls us to a holy living. We also extend grace, loving kindness, goodness, mercy, favor, and peace to everyone. We believe in the transformation of lives through the Word of God. We purpose to teach and preach in the Bible as inspired and infallible Word of God and only authoritative guide for the development and management of our lives. You know, I probably have butchered that statement quite a bit, but you know, right? They really are the essence of what all good people, all good men and women who believe in helping. And, you know, really, I mean, it teaches us not to depend upon governments or political leaders. We're blessed by God, and we're really performing God's work in everything we do, even if we're down on our luck and we've had some problems.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I'd like to share that that's more than just those statements. We actually have ways we live that out, very unique and specific things that we do and how we treat people, and it's a philosophy that runs throughout, a thread that runs throughout our ministry, both with those men and women God brings to our doors, are what we call our guests to the mission, because it's God's home for them. And so we treat them as guests to God's home, providing for them. And then it runs that same thread of grace, runs through the staff and the management, our policies, our personnel practices, because we do believe in those statements you just read. And it's kind of an unusual way to start an interview, because normally we talk about a little bit about who we are, but you hit the core of what I love to talk about. And that is, how do we get change in people? How does God change lives? How does God affect lives from one person to another? And so we believe in a couple of principles. First of all, we believe that our decisions, Bruce, and our thoughts and our actions and our attitudes all stem from what we call the heart. You have a clue kind of what I'm talking about, but when I say the heart?
I do. I think so.
Yes. Yeah. And so for those that may not understand, what do you mean the heart? It comes from the heart. The heart is where we hold our values, our principles, and our character. And those things are based upon our life. Throughout life, we build experience, good and bad. And that experience becomes our value base, which is the base that processes all the thoughts and actions through. So in other words, when we see a situation and we're dealing with a situation throughout the day, whatever that situation is, our mind by itself draws upon that value system and says, what do I do? How do I react? You see somebody walking to a door of a convenience store and you go to open the door for them. As an example, that was based upon the fact that somewhere along the line, you thought the value of helping somebody or opening a door was a good thing, and you do it. And we make these little decisions without even thinking that they're based upon a value system.
Yeah, so you're really not thinking about it. You're acting intuitively, through your heart that you want to do these good things.
Yeah, it becomes natural because we do it so often, we don't even think about it. But what happens with the people that come to Gospel Rescue Mission that are homeless and living on the streets is they've had to live a life a little bit different than you and I have, Bruce. They've had to do things and act in certain ways to survive the streets, which means they may have to lie or cheat to get what they need. They may have to hurt others to get what they need or to survive the day. They may become addicted to a drug or alcohol in order to get through the day. And so they believe that that is something they have to do, and then that addiction sets in. And so they believe that if you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you worse. They believe I've got to put walls up. This is not just the homeless, this is most everybody. I'll put walls up so I can protect myself. I don't want to be hurt. Who wants to be hurt? So in relationships, we all have certain walls, certain heights, based upon those experiences in life where we've either been encouraged and it's been successful, or we've been hurt and we've been damaged. And so these things become instilled in our heart, in our value system, so that everything we do throughout the day is based upon these values. Well, what we believe is I can't change your values, Bruce, and you can't change mine, but we believe God can. And therefore, that's where the Bible comes in. We want to teach principles that help the people understand that God's word says you don't take advantage of the others. You are kind to others. You are forgiving to others. You know, you help others. You become responsible for your life. And those are values that I think most of us would agree are good values. So where we find the values that we teach to our men and women are in the Bible. And so we pull those out, we teach the Bible, and we help them, we point the people to God so that God can get in their heart and say, you know what, you have taken advantage of people throughout life, and that's sin, and that's destructive. It's destructed your life. Cause damage as well as others. You've lost relationships with your children or your spouse or your parents because of the way you behaved, and the behavior was based upon those kind of rotten value system. So we want them, by the time they leave the rescue mission after a year, year and a half, if they go through our recovery program, we want them to come out with a whole new value set that they can now base life decisions upon that will be productive and positive to help them lead a successful life. And not hurt others and be successful. And so that value system is extremely important. And that's what makes us a little different than most secular or other recovery programs. Yes, we teach relapse prevention plan, and we teach about addiction, and we teach about the brain and how the brain works with addiction, and we teach them how to put a support system together like any other addictive recovery program would do. The difference being, we go into that value system and they don't. They teach you the tools of the trade. You know, here's what you do to put a relapse prevention plan together. And that's a good thing. It's a good tool to have in your toolbox. But if you leave the mission or any other recovery program with all these tools, but you're basing everything still upon a sticky value system from your heart, you're not going to have the change and the effect that you need to have. You're going to fail and relapse, no matter how many tools you have in your box. That is why our men and women who come through our recovery program are indeed transformed from the inside out with godly, healthy values and character. And that's what helps make them successful.
Well, Roy, those are profound words, and those profound words are put into practice every day. And I believe in them, and I know how fervently you feel about this topic. Look, let's go ahead and take a commercial break. And when we come back, I want to focus on the Center of Opportunity, which just opened, and get to talk with you about that, because it is really something very, very special. So you'll hang with us?
Yep.
Okay. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back in a minute. Welcome back to Inside Track. We are with Pastor Roy Tobin from Gospel Rescue Mission. Let's focus, Roy, on the Center of Opportunity, which just opened. What a great collaborative effort. Can you give our listeners the inside story on how this magnificent project came together?
Yeah, it's a God-orchestrated project, period. And we've had a vision in our minds for several years and our hearts about a new center we needed, and I'll tell you why in a minute, and with the idea of it being somehow a collaborative center. So if we got a new building for our men's shelter, we wanted to have enough rooms, a few extra rooms to invite organizations in to provide services they provide and give them free office space, computer, whatever they need. So we had a kind of a really tiny, small vision of what God ended up giving us. And what precipitated this was a few years ago, we had a fire in 2016 at one of our facilities near the men's shelter. And that put us on the map with the leaders of the city of South Tucson, where the men's shelter was located at the time. And so they kind of came looking around, and they realized that we had, according to the new National Fire Code, too many people in the building. They had approved it in 2006 for 102 beds plus, or 110 beds plus floor beds, which we put mats on the floor in cold or hot weather. So we have about 140 men a night. Well, the new fire code was one person per 50 square feet, not two per 50 in a bunk bed. And so they came back and said, you know, this went into effect in 2012, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and now we're enforcing it. So we got our beds cut from 140 to 55. And for us, that was a sign that God was saying, get up and walk in faith like you did when you built the new women's center back in 2009 and 10. Get up and walk in faith, and I've got something for you. I have no clue what it is. We had no money. We had no plan, just like the Women's Center. We didn't have a strategic plan. We didn't have a fundraising committee and a committee that was going to oversee the building. And then we started looking at buildings. They were a little expensive. We said, let's wait and pray. And then Humberto Lopez from HSL Properties, and he has a foundation, a family foundation as well, came to us and several other nonprofits. And I'm thinking of buying the old Palo Verde Hotel on Palo Verde, which was the Holiday Inn for years that people know it as.
Yeah.
And he said, I'd like it to be a one-stop homeless center, where it's a collaborative center where organizations come so that the homeless don't have to walk all over town and to get the services they need. It's all in one location, which is kind of that small vision that we already had, only much larger. So we didn't, you thought, this is huge, we can't do it. The other organizations, we can't. Well, he goes ahead in 2017, in September of 2017, and he purchases that hotel with the faith that God's going to use it for this purpose. He reapproaches our board in October of 17 and says to the board, I want you to bring your men's shelter there because I know you're looking for a men's shelter because you need more beds. And not only that, I want you to bring the faith component. I want that to be offered there where there's Bible studies and chapel. If people want to go, we want them, you know, to receive that there. And you will be the faith component of that center. And then the kicker was, he turned to the board president and said, I'd like you all to consider managing the whole project, not just being there, but being the anchor organization to manage. You determine what other social services, behavioral health organizations will be on site, providing what services. I want you to coordinate all that. And that was the kicker to say, okay, we won't move in there with somebody else running it. And then they say, oh, you can't do Bible studies anymore. You can't do chapel. You can't do the things that I was just, you know, talking about in terms of the faith part that deals with the heart and the values, and they go, oh, you can't do that. So we were in charge, and at that point we said we will do it. And that was in the fall of 17, and here we are a year and a half later with the building open, renovated, beautiful, and serving hundreds more people every week.
It's just incredible. You know, the shelter really just filled up practically instantaneously, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It exploded on the very first day. We didn't know what to expect. We had beds at this current time for about between 250, 300 people, depending on how many children and so forth. So we're looking at, you know, a facility up around 300 beds. started with our current shelter folks and moved them over there, our men as well as our women. Our women's shelter is there, and the current women's shelter that we've had for years that we remodeled and opened up is our women's recovery center. So we're going to continue to run that. But the shelter women will be at the due center, and then we process them, determine if they want to get into our faith-based recovery program or non-faith-based program or housing or job training. And so we kind of triage them there. And so with that, the women plus the men and then the children for both men and women could be there. There's about 300 beds. Well, the first day, you know, we moved all of our men and women over there, so we're at about 80. And the first day, we opened up with 140 new people on the very first day. Well, we had increased our staff, but nowhere near to be able to process and do interviews and intakes on 140 people.
Right.
And then we continued to get 30 the next day, 25 the next day, 40 the next day. And some of the people, you know, we got into other programs or moved out. Others came in. And so we added over 200 new people in the very first week. And we finally caught up and we're on top of things. That was June 3rd when we opened, and we're finally, you know, on top of it with the daily flow of people, a little more normal flow that we can handle of, you know, 15, 20, 25 people a day, processing them in and out of the shelter. So it just exploded, Bruce. You're right. It just was crazy fast.
So the center of opportunity is also, in addition to health and dental services, there's workforce development, there's employment services, veteran services, and assistance for affordable housing and other government assistance programs, and all of these functions under one roof where everybody can take part in these services, but also, again, getting back to the faith-based, that really is at the core of the mission here, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's going to, you know, stay at that center of opportunity. We brought that with us, and that's the value system, again, of which we operate under. Now, the others don't have to agree with it. We don't force anybody into it, but we provide it, and people are looking for it. There are people that they're desperate. They're lacking hope. They've beaten themselves up. They feel they're no good. They can't love themselves or others. And to hear that God does love you and has a plan for your life, and we give you that hope and that spiritual hope, people are just, you know, knocking the doors down to get it.
Hmm. You know, there are so many news stories about how in our country, despite such great wealth in America, there are so many who are hurting and looking for new opportunities. Will your mission ever end in that respect? I guess not.
No, I don't believe homelessness will ever end per se, although the government, you know, wants to end homelessness. 20 years ago, they're going to end homelessness in 10 years, and obviously that hasn't come about. The big push with the federal government is what they call housing first.
Yeah.
And that is get people into a house and then provide what they call wraparound services or these kind of support services we're talking about today with the center providing. But the problem is many of these places have opened up around the country, and they haven't really had the support services piece there. So you've got an apartment complex, let's say, with 50 people who are mentally ill and who are doing drugs and on drugs, and they don't function well, they don't communicate with others, they're not stabilized, and you put them all into an apartment complex, guess what you get? It's a little bit of chaos.
Yeah, not pretty.
It's not pretty. We had that years ago with a place called In-N-Up, which was a Christian, kind of a low-income Christian-supported housing hotel that they had turned into housing, much similar to what now 20 years later the government's saying to do. And that failed because the people were still doing their drugs. They're in the neighborhood. The neighbors didn't want them there. A lot of police calls with fights and different things going on, and they ultimately had to close that down. Well, our philosophy, Bruce, is different. Our philosophy is stabilization first. It's housing next, not housing first. So in other words, get people, help them stabilize, get them sober, get them the medical and the mental health help they need to stabilize, then provide job training, as you said, workforce development, job training, GEDs, give them a skill set, have them go to recovery classes, life skills classes like boundaries and grief and loss counseling, and get them what they need counseling-wise with addiction work. And now they're stabilized. They've been sober and clean for a year or so, or 6 months, however long, and now move them into permanent housing where they're able to really work a job if they can work and they're not on disability, work so they have income to help pay for that apartment in the months ahead. And they're stable and they're productive citizens in the community.
Roy, I'm gonna have to stop us right here. We're right up against the end of the hour.
Okay.
Roy, how can our listeners get involved as a volunteer or a donor?
Yeah, we need both of those. Donations, you can donate financially. Just mail a check to our office that's on the website, grmtucson.com. Or you can drop off donations of household goods, furniture, clothing, to either our women's or men's or center of opportunity or our women's center on Miracle Mile. And we need lots of volunteers to greet people, to help serve them lunch and dinner at the tables, and work the front area to just talk to people and encourage them.
Pastor Roy, thank you very much. You're going to be back on the show soon. In fact, Bert Lopez is going to come on the show to talk about his participation. And I, as a fellow human being and as a fellow resident of here in Tucson, thank you so much for doing the great work, the great ministry that you've done for so many years. God bless.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That's going to do it for today's show. Tune in next Saturday for a special 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 lunar landing with special guest, former Apollo astronaut Jim McDivitt. Until then, for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.